WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Jimmy Carter, America's 39th president, died last week at the age of 100. So we dug through the archives and found an interview with Jimmy Carter here on WBEZ from back in 1988. He was in Chicago promoting his latest book, An Outdoor Journal, Adventures and Reflections. Now, it's kind of surreal to hear this interview with Jimmy Carter, because even though it was recorded about 36 years ago, it sounds like it could have been today. He talks about climate change, efforts to rely on clean energy, even presidential transitions of power. We wanted to share a bit of that interview with you. The first voice that you'll hear is former WBEZ host Ken Davis.
You proclaimed yourself to be America's first environmentalist president. I really can't resist asking you, since it's been now just about 8 years since you were in the Oval Office, whether you would agree with the critics who say that in the last 8 years we've been sliding backwards, not going forward as far as environmental policy.
We have. In the past, under both Democratic and Republican presidents, there was a strong leadership in the White House concerning environmental issues. Mm-hmm. All the way back to Abraham Lincoln and Theodore Roosevelt. And in fact, the Environmental Protection Agency was established under a Democratic Congress and under President Nixon and the Council of Environmental Quality. Under President Reagan, though, there's been a radical departure from that commitment. He went into office proclaiming that pollution came from trees, and he's appointed people like James Watt to be the Secretary of Interior. And there's been a gross giveaway of American precious possessions like major forest stands and the right to drill oil offshore, just dumping on the market excessive quantities, which depress the prices. The Council of Environmental Quality is almost non-existent now, and the Environmental Protection Agency has been seriously damaged. We've seen Reagan every year advocating dramatic reductions in allocation of federal funds just to maintain the national park system in spite of increasing use with population growth. And there's been no attention given to problems like acid rain, or the carbon dioxide buildup in the outer atmosphere, or the depletion of the ozone layer in the polar regions. I would guess, though, that, that whether Bush or Dukakis is elected in January, that there'll be a resumption of interest in the environmental status of life on a global basis by the next president.
You're visiting Chicago today, and you're obviously someone who gets to travel around the country a lot, and I'm sure that just about everywhere you're going, you're seeing the same thing. In the last few days, or in the last few weeks, we've registered the largest number of high temperatures in Chicago's history.
Yes.
Yesterday, we registered the highest ozone level ever scored in the Midwest in Chicago.
Yes.
The weather is reaching just absolutely unbelievable proportions of danger. And this is, and Chicago is fortunate because we're sitting right on the lake, so we have a great deal of relief from this. Obviously, when you get a little further away, it's much worse. There are a number of alarmists who are saying that we're seeing the first tangible evidence of the greenhouse effect, that the ozone hole and all of this, it's all coming home to roost. I'd like to just ask you, as someone who has studied the environment, you're as academically and intellectually qualified to comment as anyone else. First of all, are you a believer in that? Do you think that we really are seeing some kind of a global warming?
Yes, I think so. When I was president and used to meet with other leaders of industrial nations, like Chancellor Helmut Schmidt from Germany, His primary consideration about the present and the future was a buildup of carbon dioxide in the outer atmosphere and the inevitable slow warming effect that would melt the ice cap, raise the level of all the oceans and lakes to extraordinary heights in the years to come, and would cause a general change in the climate, not only in the big cities like Chicago, where this is your first consideration, but in increasing drought experiences during the summer months and growing months in the Midwest and the South in the major agricultural areas. I think this is happening, and we also see in the Sahara region of Africa an increasing trend toward desertification of previously arable land. We've had a net decrease per capita in the production of food grains in Africa in the last 15 years, and no increase in the production of beef or seafood. So I think that there is a genuine concern. The thing is, we ought not to be alarmist and gloomsayers. We ought to realize that if we take action now of a reasonable and constructive nature on an international basis, we can reverse these trends and protect the environment not only in the present years but also in decades to come.
And that leads us to an obvious two-part question, which is, what can we do? And secondly, how can we possibly get any kind of an international agreement on what needs to be done?
The fact is that other nations are ready to take action, and the United States is not. We'll find an eager group of partners in Canada and in Europe, particularly in Scandinavia, in the entire developed world. I think even the Soviets would be willing to do this on a global scale. But in our country in recent years, there's been a philosophical aversion to, opposition to, looking to the future, because President Reagan feels very deeply, and I don't criticize him because of this, that any sort of planning for the future was an intervention in the free enterprise system, that we ought not to say what is going to be happening in the year 2000 or in the year 2015 and so forth, that this is contrary to his philosophy. I think this will be reversed. Other nations are doing it. So it's not a matter of the entire world being reluctant. It's for the entire world waiting for the most powerful and influential nation on Earth to play an equal role, or particularly a leading role. That's what we need.
So our nation, particularly if we happened, at least in an environmental sense, to be allied with the Soviet Union, the two of us together could lead the world in this?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. And even if the Soviets were reluctant to do this, as I said, the European nations and other industrialized nations around the world, including Australia, Japan, Canada, are very eager to see us move forward now.
There has been some agreement, at least on the limitation and production of chlorofluorocarbons in this and other countries, but it always sort of begs that question of the developing nations of the world sort of looking at us and saying, well, isn't that nice? You know, you all have air conditioners in your cars, and we have nothing, and we want some of this technology. And you have the nerve to look at us and say, well, we're going to have to call a halt to this.
Well, as you know, they're very good substitutes for chlorofluorocarbons. And I think that the recent international agreement, although it was a step forward, in effect just froze the level of the use of these materials now, instead of absolutely decreasing them rapidly and then doing away with them. And every time we use these materials, either for air conditioning or for hairspray and that sort of thing, we're additionally damaging the ozone layer. And I don't think anyone yet has figured out, even in the advanced scientific community, the ultimate consequences of the ozone layer being destroyed. We know it is being destroyed. I think there's a much more tangible assessment being made now, a much more believable assessment being made now of the dangers of increased carbon dioxide buildup, which is raising temperatures.
You, I think, raised the hopes of a lot of people who had numbers of concerns about the environment when you were president, because you seemed to be taking a decisive leadership role in the development of what we have broadly called alternative generation of energy, not only solar but lots of other things. We've seen clearly a decline in that in the last 8 years. I suppose some of it might be leadership, but some of it seems to also be technology, that it just didn't seem to catch on for one reason or another. And I wonder, you must have been thinking about that quite a bit.
But the technology is there to have clean-burning coal-fired power plants. you can either use clean burning coal from the strip mine areas in Colorado in the west, or you can have scrubbers in the exhaust areas when you even burn high carbon or high sulfur coal. Mm-hmm. But we don't have any leadership from Washington to say this must be done. Mm-hmm. And the opposition is not just from President Reagan. There are always people who produce high sulfur coal that want to continue to use it and don't want to use scrubbers. Mm-hmm. There are always mm-hmm. major power companies that don't want to go to the additional expense of cleaning up what's causing acid rain. So it's not something that can be uniquely blamed on the president. But without presidential leadership, mm-hmm. There's no way to move forward, because you can always oppose things from the White House, and that's it.
President Jimmy Carter also talked to WBEZ host Ken Davis about the challenges of bipartisanship and the three qualities that he said every president should personify. Let's listen.
It's obvious that you have been very much active in the political scene since you left office. You've been very active in a lot of ways, the Habitat for Humanity and all those kinds of things. But yet you have been, at least I would say, relatively low key as far as your public statements are concerned. And I just wonder if you could sort of get personal with us and talk about how this must feel and whether or not there isn't some kind of an urging in there somewhere that you want to get back into a policymaking level in the government, that if asked, you would like to be Secretary of Interior or Secretary of State or something like that.
I don't want a job in Washington, but the things that we do now are very exciting to us. Mm-hmm. You know, we deal with U.S.-Soviet relations, with nuclear arms control, mm-hmm. with Middle East peace process. We work on improving human rights around the world and democracy in this hemisphere at a very high level, working with heads of government. In all these areas, President Gerald Ford has been my co-chairman. We work at the Carter Center on a nonpartisan or bipartisan basis. Mm-hmm. When we assess the global problems with primary health care, our co-chairman, that would be President Reagan's own Assistant Secretary for Health Care. And so we have tried at the Carter Center to be effective on a global basis by not being partisan in nature. Mm-hmm. Within an academic environment at the highest possible level of expert knowledge and mm-hmm. influence in government and otherwise, we work on a nonpartisan basis. And I think this is the best way for me to proceed. If the next president, though, for instance, whether it's Bush or Dukakis, would ask, say, me and President Ford to take a leading role mm-hmm. in trying to explore ways to renew the peace effort in the Middle East, I don't have any doubt that we would be glad to take that on as a temporary challenge if we had the flexibility and the authority to mm-hmm. act responsibly. Something of that kind would be appropriate.
Well, I mean, you say you don't want to work in Washington, but you know, I mean, so you can do it without living in Washington. You know
well,
what I mean?
I don't have anything against Washington. As a matter of fact, President Ford and I are doing something now that never has been done in this country before. We formed what's called the American Agenda. Last February, we contacted all the active candidates on Republican and Democratic side for mm-hmm. president and notified them that we would do this work. We have about 90 or 100 of the foremost experts in our nation on foreign policy and domestic affairs. Mm-hmm. And we've had meetings already. We'll have a next meeting in September at the Carter Center in Atlanta. And we'll go and meet with the president-elect shortly after the November election, whether it's Bush or Dukakis. Mm-hmm. And we'll present to that person who will be our next president. President Ford and I will do this in person. These are some of the options that you might want to consider in how to deal with the Soviet Union, how to deal with the Middle East peace process, how to deal with Central America, how to deal with the deficit and so forth, how to deal with environmental issues. And then, of course, the president-elect can either accept or reject these things.
Yeah.
But we'll add a nonpartisan element to some very controversial and politically difficult decisions that mm-hmm. the next president will make. Mm-hmm. In addition, President Ford and I have pledged ourselves to try to heal some of the wounds or divisions that presently exist between the White House and Capitol Hill mm-hmm. and between Republicans and Democrats in the Congress. So I think that two former presidents, for the first time, so far as I know, in history, will be trying to work together harmoniously with the next president, but not trying to be presumptuous or inject ourselves into mm-hmm. the process. We'll mm-hmm. do it in a very private and unpublicized fashion.
A lot of political types have drawn a number of parallels between you and Dukakis. Former governors, very hands-on types, involved in very much the day-to-day minutia of the operation of their governments, and that if Dukakis is elected, he may in many ways be a similar kind of president. You share that view?
Well, it's a compliment to me when people compare us. When I was a naval officer, I tried to know what I was doing when I was responsible for the safety of a submarine. When I was a businessman, I tried to be know what was going on in my business. Yeah. When I was governor, when I was running for president, I did. When I got to be president, I thought it was the biggest job in the world. And I studied and I learned the issues that only I could address, not some cabinet officer and so forth. And I think that this is what a president ought to be. I think there are three basic elements that any president ought to personify. One is the president ought to always tell the truth, so that when he has a press conference, when he makes a statement, the world will know this man is telling the truth. I don't think that's asking too much. Secondly, I think the president ought to be competent. He ought to know what's going on in the White House, at least, and preferably he ought to know what's going on in the rest of the government, the major things. And I think third, the president ought to be compassionate. He ought to be concerned about improving the quality of life of people who live in the nation which he governs. I don't think that's asking too much.
That was former President Jimmy Carter when he stopped by WBEZ in 1988. Now, what we played for you was a lightly edited excerpt, and you can hear the full interview at WBEZ.org. This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced and mixed by Meha Ahmed and edited by Dan Tucker. Reset brings you the news through important, curious, and insightful conversations. If you like what you hear, please subscribe wherever you listen or visit us at WBEZ.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks so much for listening.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.